Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
It's that time of the week when your outpost is freshly delivered, and I am one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is always, the bountiful, beautiful, and, well, just all-out amazing, Drea Kaufman.
Hello!
How are ya?
I'm good. How are you?
You know what? Doing pretty well. I feel like that the weeks are just flying by. You know, we're already in September, which is kind of nuts.
I know. We're like halfway through September. We're more than halfway through September. I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's crazy. But you know what was really cool today? Randomly, I checked the old Instagram and I had a message that was waiting for me from a person named Matt Weasley. And they're from Australia. And this was their note to me. They said, "Hey, mate. Love listening to your podcast all the way in Sydney, Australia. Keep up the good work. Gets me home after work and busy traffic. You and Drea are fantastic." So, wow. That's so cool. All the way from Australia.
I know. And I love your Instagram handle. That's amazing.
It is awesome. It is awesome. So thank you, Matt Weasley. We appreciate it. And good on you, mate, for sending us a note. We really appreciate that. And gosh, thanks for finding us all the way in Australia. That's awesome. I mean, I don't know. That's amazing.
I love your bonding attempt with the Australians right now. It's real nice.
Well, you know, I figured
your Australian accent.
Yeah, since they said mate, then I should be able to say mate. It's cool. So I appreciate that. I appreciate you allowing me to feel like I'm an Australian for about, you know, 3 seconds.
So. All I can think of now when I hear that, though, is The Good Place. There's an episode where one of the characters is like, "I did all of this work to perfect this amazing Australian accent, and I didn't even get to use it." That's what's running through my mind right now.
Oh,
so if you
man.
Haven't watched The Good Place, you should.
Well, it's something I think is probably going to be on the list because everybody keeps raving about it. So
it's great.
Yeah, but very cool. Thank you so much, Matt Weasley, for reaching out. It means so much to us to hear those kind of things that people are enjoying the show and, gosh, listening to it all over the world, which is really exciting, which you can do wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us all over the place. But if you do happen to want to give us a star rating review, one of the best places to do that is over on iTunes because that is still where most of the people in the world get their podcasts. And it really does help the show grow when you give us a star rating review. It helps us come up when people are searching for Harry Potter podcasts. So do that and we'll call you out on the show. Send us messages wherever you are. You know, Drea and I both have handles on Twitter. We both have Instagram. There's also the @joinnerdparty on Twitter, which if you're listening to Outpost, follow that because you'll get all the news about Outpost and everything else that's going on the Nerd Party Network. There's so many great shows happening. We'd love for you to check all of them out. And that is a great way to keep track of things. And use the #Outpost and Drea and I will talk back to you. We love getting a chance to interact with everybody. Another great place to do that, honestly, is on Facebook because every week, over at facebook.com/thenerdparty, Drea and I, we post the show, and if anybody comments under there, we talk back. And so we love to get the opportunity to be able to talk to you that way. So, you know, follow us and like us over on Facebook at facebook.com/thenerdparty, and we'll get that opportunity. And again, there's so many great shows that are coming out here from the network, so you'll get an opportunity to see what else is there. We're also over on the web at thenerdparty.com, and if you want us to send us the email, do that. Go to thenerdparty.com/contact, choose a show, choose Outpost, and then Drea and I can talk to you that way as well. So just a plethora of ways to be able to talk to us. But Drea, you know, I feel like getting to this chapter, 31, the third task, we really are winding this book down. And there's so much that happens in this chapter.
This is a very long chapter. And I mean that in a good way, but it's a very long chapter.
It is. It is. And what I also you know, we've been commenting that each of these chapters over the last few weeks have just been kind of picking up right where we left off. And again, we do that here, you know, and we see that Harry is telling Ron and Hermione everything that he's learned from the Pensieve and from Dumbledore in his office. And they're having this long conversation. They're up late at night again. And, you know, one of the things I really loved about this whole section was, one, you know, we can tell that the kids are getting older because, you know, they're staying up later and not really caring about it. And two, I just love the interaction here with the Trinity as they are trying to figure these things out, and they're all kind of bringing their own, you know, bits and pieces to it. And it just makes for, I think, these are my favorite scenes in the book when the kids are, you know, having these conversations together. I just always enjoy it.
It's interesting too, because we talk about over the course of the books how Ron sort of represents the traditional wizarding values or perspective, if you will, and this is kind of another little piece of that. We talked in not the last chapter, but I think it was two chapters or so ago, the madness of Mr. Crouch, how, you know, Fudge is very like sort of racist against giants and giant blood and that sort of thing. And here's a little bit of, you know, Ron sort of tentatively sharing that perspective as well. And Hermione's very quick to jump to, you know, her defense and say, you know, if I was subject to that kind of prejudice, I would also just say I'm big boned. Like, I wouldn't want to tell people, you know. So just another little insight into that larger wizarding world perspective that, you know, she gives you that glimpse again.
Yeah, I really liked that because I thought it emphasizes the, like you were talking about, just these prejudices and the kind of the ridiculousness of them, but also how entrenched they are. And like you said, you know, For Ron, it's different than him and Hermione, who are just kind of coming into this magical world and they don't have those prejudices, so they see things with a different set of glasses on. And I really like the way that Hermione responds to Ron in this. I think it's really nice. And it shows Hermione's character, you know, here, and I really appreciate that. I also thought it was interesting too because they have a, you know, they're talking through all this and they're like, man, you know, Dumbledore trusts Snape even though he was a Death Eater. And Harry's like, yes. And it's just so fascinating to see how all of these things are working together and all these things are coming together. And I mean, they talk about, you know, the fact that Ludo Bagman, and they've been getting all these warnings, you know, from people, whether it was Winky or others, about how he's, you know, not a good guy. And in fact, even Rita Skeeter had said that, you know, that things, she knew things about him that would make their toes curl. So, I mean, this is, it's just fascinating to me to watch, like, again, we've always been talking about the puzzles, the puzzle pieces, and they are slowly coming together here, and we're getting closer and closer to having all of them, you know, finally create the picture. And it's just interesting to see them have this kind of one last conversation together like this, where they're really frustrated because they can't see the picture clearly yet. It feels like they're close, but it's still really muddy.
Right. And I like that she ends this little section here at the beginning with a couple of sort of Harry's internal thoughts. I like when we get those because I feel like the movies skim over those because they're really hard to convey in a thematic setting. So I like, first of all, that he tells Ron and Hermione pretty much everything that happens in Dumbledore's office, but he does keep his word and does not share Neville's history, and sort of has this introspective moment looking on Neville and sort of like, you know, everyone pitied me and felt sorry for me being an orphan, but he's like, I imagine what he goes through is like way worse than what I was going through. So for him to have that moment sort of quietly to himself, and then it's sort of the first time that Because throughout all the books, Harry's been like, no one's going to do this for me. You know, stop sacrificing yourselves, you know, for me, blah, blah, blah. And this is kind of the first time where he kind of realizes, like, every bad thing that happens all kind of rolls back to Voldemort. It all is there. And I think that was such a deep sort of realization for him. Like, you know, you're like, well, yeah, it is. Of course it is. But for, you know, a 15, 16-year-old kid... 14? I have no idea how old he is this time. I think he's 15.
He's 14.
For him to have that realization and be like, this is not me. This is something bigger than us, I think was really, really interesting and shows his maturity. And it's just like, again, goes back to your point earlier about they're growing. These kids are growing up. So I really enjoyed the way she sort of wrapped that up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought that was a really strong part of the story and really well done. I love the section too, you know, after that where Ron and Hermione are supposed to be studying for, you know, their end of year exams and stuff, and Harry's exempt from those because he's a Triwizard champion. But instead of studying, they're helping him study for the third task, and they're learning all these hexes and jinxes and everything, and they're talking about, well, at least we'll do well in Defense Against the Dark Arts, which is actually fascinating to see Hermione in this situation not caring about grades, which I thought was a real, like you were talking a minute ago about growth for Harry, and I feel like we're seeing growth for all of these characters. You know, for her to say that there's something more important than her grades at this moment, I think is really nice to see, like that she's able to put that aside and help out a friend in need. I think shows a tremendous amount of growth for Hermione, whereas other, I think earlier books, she would have probably really kind of struggled with, do I study or, you know, do I help Harry? And here it's just become, no, I help Harry. And I feel like it's neat to see these kids kind of rubbing off on each other in such a good way where Hermione, I think, is learned a little bit from Harry and Ron that ability to put others first like this. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, and it does. It shows that growth. It's great to see those two growing up and... you know, we look forward to kind of Ron having the same moment. But yeah, I agree.
Well, not only that, I love Ron's little saying. He's like, this is great training from when we're all at Auror's.
Yeah, I love that. That was so cute.
So cute. But you know, what I kind of liked about that at this moment, too, is that we're talking about growing up. You know, they are kind of starting to see maybe what their future might hold, you know, beyond Hogwarts. And that's one of the things that this book has really done, you know, specifically with like Fred and George really focusing on what's going to happen after Hogwarts. And later on in the chapter, you know, we meet Bill Weasley, who's back. And, you know, he hasn't been back to Hogwarts for 5 years. So this book is kind of transitioning us into a place where these kids are starting to kind of see their life beyond being at school, which is, it's fun. But what I think is just so smart about it is just, it just feels real. You know, there's a point in, you know, high school where you start to think about what's going to come after this, you know, and these kids are at the age when those start, you know, those questions really start to, you know, formulate for them. And then there's this weird little moment where they look out the window and Crabbe and Malfoy and Goyle are doing something very strange next to a tree. And it looks like, you know, he's holding a walkie-talkie, but of course he can't be holding a walkie-talkie, and they have no idea what's going on. But it's just this weird little scene that will mean something in a little bit.
At like the very end of the book. Well, it'll come to mean something here in a minute, and then Hermione will figure it out, and then we'll all figure it out at the end of the book.
Yes. Yeah, it's just a strange little moment, so. And I would say, you know, Harry also handles himself very well when the next Rita Skeeter column comes out. I feel like he doesn't even blink. He reads it and he's like, ah, really? That's the best she's got? I love his response to this.
I love that. And I love what this article does. So this article is just full of nonsense. It's just total BS, the entire thing, right? It's got some factual points like, yes, Harry is a parcel tongue, but there's a reasonable explanation for it and the world doesn't need to know and it doesn't make him evil. Like, you know, there's, yes, he's friends with a giant and a werewolf and a convicted killer and like all of these things, right? Like, yes, on paper, these are terrible. But I like that this sort of barrage against Harry starts here. Because it's going to become a very big part going forward. And I like that we're eased into it a little bit. And he gets mm-hmm. some familiarity with it. He gets used to it a little bit before we kind of are hit with a barrage in the next book. And I'm not really giving anything away. Like, not a huge plot point that I'm spoiling for anyone here. But this exposure to the media in a not so positive light, because up until this point, you know, he's basically been the golden child. Even in Rita Skeeter's eyes, he's sort of been this like golden child, right? This underdog hero, the true victor of Hogwarts, right? As we're reminded from Diggory's from Cedric's parents in this chapter. I think it's just interesting that this is kind of the first time he gets bad press, and he just sort of lets it roll off, and he's like, ha 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 ha. He's got this like almost fake confident laugh about it, and he, like, genuinely doesn't care, but it's got this like, oh, ha 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 sort of feeling to it. And it's such an interesting part. And I like that it's in here and it's this little article. And I would be angry if I were Harry. That article is just total BS. It just made me angry just to read it. And of course, Malfoy's in it. Of course he is. He'd jump on an opportunity to slander Harry, you know, so
the growth of Harry, you know, to completely not care about what is being said about him because he just doesn't care. I think is fantastic, and at the same time, I think what she's doing here, she's really showing how the media, you know, you're the media darling at one moment, and then the next moment they're trying to tear you down. Because yeah. It sells all the papers to build you up, and it sells all the papers to tear you down. And
it's the sensationalism of it all.
Yes, absolutely. And so, like you said, you know, all of these facts, when taken out of context, look really bad. But when we know them in context, it's like there's nothing wrong with any of this. And
right.
So
no one needs to launch a full scale investigation mm-hmm. into a 15-year-old kid or a 14-year-old kid at Hogwarts. Like, yeah. We're okay, people.
Well, and again, when you twist something out of context, it's proof positive here, right here. Context is king. Like, if you don't know the context, you actually don't know anything. And it's the difference between facts and wisdom, you know, and so what we're seeing here is people getting mixed up in this and starting to believe this. And we even see that when the Weasleys come later on, and Mrs. Weasley at the beginning is cold to Hermione because she's read this crap and it affects her. And so we're seeing the effect that the media, whether or not it's true or not, or whether we know we should be listening to or not. If you hear something enough, you will start to believe it.
Well, and I feel like Mrs. Weasley
was—that's the danger.
Was swayed by some of that media early on too. I think some of those stories about even before we went back to Hogwarts at the very beginning of the book, she had a couple moments where she was sort of swayed by some of mm-hmm. the media publishing, you know, and even though it was about her own family, I think it was the stories about Arthur and Mad-Eye Moody and all of and Arthur and the World Cup and all of that. I remember even some of that she was a little swayed by, and it was her own husband, her own family. She knew firsthand the truth, and it still had a very powerful sway on her. So I think it's interesting that she's just the character who sort of serves as that gullible person. I don't have a better way to put it, but she's very susceptible. She's the most susceptible person to this sort of media blitz and the sensationalism and what it all is.
Right.
Even though in her heart of hearts, she knows better. And as soon as Harry sort of mentions it, you know, like, oh, you know, she's not my girlfriend. We know that's all fake, right? She's like, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. She had to be snapped back. And she did, but it did take an actual conscious act to kind of bring her back from that. And before we go too far away from it, I do love that, you know, Mrs. Weasley and Bill are there because it's family. The families mm-hmm. are invited of the champions. And I love how, you know, he's like, the Dursleys didn't come. There's no way the Dursleys came.
Yeah.
And then Cedric's like, come on, they're
please
waiting.
Please don't let them have been here.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, God, they're not here, are they? And then he opens the door and it's Mrs. Weasley and Bill. And I just love.
Yes.
I love that they came. I love that they're family. I love that they sort of like button that up real nicely for you. And that I love mm-hmm. that Harry got someone and he wasn't sort of, you know, all by himself. I always wonder when you watch those reality TV shows and they bring the families in one of the last episodes, I'm like, what happens if the family doesn't want to come? Like, what do you do? Mm-hmm. Like, how awkward is that? But yeah, so I really love that they were able to get the Weasleys and that Dumbledore knew him and them well enough to know that, like, that's who he would want there. You know, if he can't have Sirius, that's yeah. who he wants. So.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a wonderful little surprise here. And again, it's one of those places where the book just does such a much better job than the movie really expounding on this and making it feel special. Yeah. And not only that, but, you know, before we get too far into that, we forgot that Hermione runs off as they're sitting here talking about things because she's putting together that thing that happened with Malfoy and Crabbe and Goyle. And then what this article is saying, and she runs off to the library, and Ron's like, man, I hope she's not late to our, you know, history of magic test. She must, you know, really think she's got something figured out if she's willing to be late to a test.
And she's willing to not even be late. She's willing to risk the possibility of being late, which I love the
awesome.
Distinction, like, that she's so neurotic that just the thought of potentially being late was enough to, like, warrant concern from them.
It's fantastic. And I, you know, as you were saying, I absolutely 100% love the fact that Bill and Mrs. Weasley are here. It means so much to have them there. I think it's really cool. I kind of like how Harry realizes that Floor is really giving Bill the eye, and apparently she does not mind that. Yeah, she does not mind the ponytail and the earring.
Yeah, I think it's cute because it's sort of a turn, like I don't know, it's like a turnabout, right? Because normally Floor is the one getting all the attention from people, and she's the one mm-hmm. that they're looking at, and you know, she's Parvila, so she usually has that sway for the, you know, shoe to be on the other foot and her to be checking someone out versus the other way around. It's just such a unique little turn. And it, like, I really think Harry got a little bit of a jolly watching her, like, check him out. Cause she's like, hey, he's like, ha ha ha. The first time that it's the other way around. So I really liked that.
No, I love you pointing that out, the fact that Floor is the one who is used to having the attention, but her giving her attention to Bill Weasley, you know, what I think this says is Bill Weasley is gotta be a looker, like a really good looking guy for, you know, a family that she probably possibly would look down on before. But I also, I'm wondering, does she remember that this is Ron's brother, who she, you know, she has gotten closer to Harry and Ron because they saved her sister, you know? So I wonder if that plays into this at all, where she sees him and, like, all of those things put together, it's like he's hot, and, you know, the fact that he comes from a family that helped save her sister, you know, I wonder if that has anything to do with it.
I don't know. I always took it differently. That definitely could be the case. And I don't think there's one way or the other. I always mm-hmm. took it as everyone has very unique tastes in what they look for in a significant other or a partner or friends or spouses or whatever you want to call them. And I feel like she just has this, like, I feel like Bill has just got it. He knows who he is. He's confident. He doesn't care if his hair is long. He's got this earring.
Yeah.
He's good at what he does. I feel like she's more attracted to the confidence than just him. And the fact that I think he's not really paying her attention, I think she liked that. Like, she's not used to that. And so that was different. And I think that it's just, he's got like an air about him. And I always sort of read it that way, that like, she liked that he was different from all the other people she usually interacts with. Like, she isn't kind of what you traditionally think he would go. He's not what you would traditionally think she would go for, kind of like you mentioned. And I wonder if she's coming around on that a little bit. And I'm wondering if that's just like her thing. I don't know. Like, that's how I sort of always took it. That was just her thing.
No, I agree with you. And my speculation was actually complete speculation. Like, it just came into my head. So it wasn't like that was anything I actually thought was, you know, the case. I just wondered, you know, reading the book like this, you start to kind of think differently.
Yeah.
Because you're reading everything so deliberately. And so, but no, I agree. I always initially took it, the idea that, you know, she is a character who very much probably likes somebody who is what you just said, very much in charge of themselves, you know, looks confident. And I think, you know, Bill is definitely one of those characters. He seems to be very comfortable in his own skin. He probably exudes that air of confidence. And not only that, but, you know, with the long hair and the earring, he probably gives a little bit of a bad boy vibe, too, at the same time. So, you know, I mean, wouldn't be the first girl that, you know, saw a guy that looked a little bit dangerous, but also seemed like a great guy.
Fell victim to the wild child syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so I love that. And I just love this whole day of Harry spending time with the Weasleys. And, you know, there's a point in this where he thinks to himself, when he's sitting at the table and he's sitting around with all of the Weasleys and, you know, Hermione and everything, then it feels like he's just back at the Burrow, and he's almost completely forgot the fact that they're here for the challenge. And it's really made him feel so much more comfortable with that day. And I just, it creates this really nice sense of as the reader, like a comfort level for you before you get to this challenge. And by the end of this chapter, you know, everything is about to go horribly wrong. So this whole section here kind of gives you that warm glow before you go into some stuff that's just going to get pretty rough in the next few weeks as we're talking through those chapters.
Yeah, I feel like she could have made this a separate chapter, though. Like, everything we've gone through so far, you could have ended it here, and this could have been one chapter, especially considering the fact that the next two chapters are relatively small themselves. I think you could have made this another small chapter and then had two small chapters talking about the lead up to it, and then also talking about the actual the task itself, because we're going to get into that next, and it's all one big chapter. And I feel a little bit like things got lost, just because there was so much in the chapter. So, I mean, I honestly think she could have, but so after this, we now lead into the actual tournament, the actual task.
Well, before we lead into the tournament, though, we should just mention that Harry does have an interesting conversation with Bill and Mrs. Weasley about the fact that Percy is really having a very hard time after this Mr. Crouch business, and he's been under investigation, basically, and really struggling with what's happened. And so that's an important little tidbit that we learn from their time together, because he actually asks about Percy, which, again, I think shows the growth of Harry to ask about something that, you know, I mean, him and Percy have never been close. But the fact that he cares enough to see how things are going with him after what he knows is going to be very difficult for Percy is, again, it shows Harry's heart and it shows his character, I think.
Yeah, and I find it interesting that, you know, that that's brought up too, and that there's this indication that, you know, the instructions that Percy was getting from Mr. Crouch may not have actually been from Mr. Crouch.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's really interesting. You get a little more tidbit of information there, and that, you know, he's been removed as the judge on behalf of Mr. Crouch, and Cornelius Fudge himself will be there at the third task instead. So that's also, all of this is sort of very, very different from the movie. We sort of completely deviated from any relation to the movie. All of this is new, and basically most of the rest of the book will be at least slightly different, if not very different, from how the movie plays out. So, you know, some key big elements still happen, but then there's a couple big storylines that never make it to the movies. So, I find it interesting that we're deviating, and I like the book storyline a lot better than the movie storyline.
Yes.
It has much more depth so far. So I'm really enjoying, and I'm really enjoying that we're spending more time with the Weasleys as a family versus just extra characters. So.
Well, and I think, you know, as we get to the actual task, it's much more interesting to read because a lot more variety happens. I mean, we have a whole reason for the Blas and Skewerts being there because they've grown huge and they're part of the challenge now here, the creatures you'd run into. We have the running into the Sphinx.
I love, though, my favorite part of all of this, I mean, I really love the Sphinx. I always think that those are such fascinating creatures whenever you find them in games. But I think my favorite part so far was this little... So Ron and Harry and Hermione all practice all of these hexes and all of these spells. And the one that becomes the most important spell in the entire section is this one that points his wand north. It's like a compass, and you're like, that's not even a hex, not even a defensive spell, anything like that. It's literally this informational spell that tells him, like, points his wand north so he can go north. And I was like, that is brilliant. And the fact that they took the time to learn that and perfect that so that he had that in his tool belt just speaks volumes to their thinking patterns and their thinking outside the box. And I was like, yes. And I love it's such a small little part. He uses it like 3 or 4 times to keep him kind of going. And I love that little detail. It just, I don't know, it really spoke to me for whatever reason.
No, I agree with you. I'm right there with you. That's the spell that I thought was so cool that he learns. And not only that, but, you know, knowing what comes in the future, there are a lot of spells that are used here that will come into play in the next few books that Harry knows because of this, that him and Ron and Hermione actually all know because they've been practicing together.
Right.
Which, you know, it this story, the way she's building it and the reason for them knowing all these things, it's just such good writing, and I can't wait to kind of see how that all plays out. But, you know, we also have Fleur scream. You know, we never actually see what happens to her. And then Cedric gets attacked by Victor Krum, and Harry actually comes to save him. And they fight off Victor Krum together, which is very interesting.
Well, not only does Victor Krum come at them, he comes at them with an unforgivable curse, which is huge.
Yes.
And they're all like, that was very unexpected. Like, we thought he was a good guy, but here he is casting the Cruciatus on Cedric, which is just, I mean, that's huge. And that speaks to, I think they paint that story much better in the movie, and maybe we'll get it after we get out of the maze here. You know, in the movie, the fog or mist or whatever kind of convinces them to be a bigger version of what they are, right? More competitive, more animalistic. It has this, like, brings out the selfish qualities in you. Like, it just amplifies all of those, like, qualities. And so we don't get that description here. We just know that Krum cast the Cruciatus on him and they froze him. And they're like, should we, like, call for sparks for him? Like, should we save him or just let him lay there face down, or what should we do? But yeah, it was an interesting, a very dark, dark turn. It wasn't quite as lighthearted as you get in the movie, even though the movie's not that lighthearted. But they're very, very clear here that Krum crossed a line.
Well, and that's, like you said, that's the interesting thing, is we get Harry thinking to himself, you can go to Azkaban for that. Like, why, did you really want to win that badly that you would use the Cruciatus curse? I mean, So yeah, they are very perplexed by the fact that he would do this. Mm-hmm. Harry comes to Cedric's rescue once again with a spider that is attacking him, and they end up able to fight off the spider. And then they have what I think is probably the cutest argument ever about who should grab the cup and why, because both of them, I actually think, Harry, it's not necessarily him being noble, but he truly feels like Cedric won. Yeah. He does not feel right grabbing the cup, because he believes that, look, if we're in a race and this is the game, there's no way I can get to the cup and beat you. So you've beaten me. And I thought that was, it just shows Harry's fairness in that way.
He plays by the rules. Hermione has rubbed off on him that way, right?
Yes.
I do love, though, that the answer to the Sphinx question is spider, and then a giant spider attacks. I feel like Harry has this moment where he's like, oh, of course. Of course. I should have seen that coming. but I sort of feel like he has that moment of like, ugh. Stupid Harry. I do love that they're both staring there at that cup, and Cedric's fixated, and he saves him again. I do love that moment. And I do love the little argument over the cup. It's almost like that, no, you hang up. No, you hang up first. They're having their own Triwizard version of the you hang up the phone first. And it's because they have this newfound bromance, right? Like, they've grown this mutual respect in these weird circumstances, and they sort of admire each other for different reasons, and they have this like weird little bromance. They're like, no, you grab the cup. No, you. Okay, let's grab it together.
And not only that, but part of that comes from earlier part that we didn't talk about, when the families are there and Amos Diggory is kind of being a little bit of a turd.
He's very towards Harry. Of Cedric.
Yes. Well, and I love Cedric too, because he's like, under his breath, he tells Harry, he's like, just don't pay attention to him. And so I feel like this whole book has really built this little relationship with Harry and Cedric, where they do have this kind of begrudging respect for each other. And even though Harry doesn't want to like this kid, he does, because even though he took away the girl he likes, right, this is a good guy. Like, Cedric is a good man. He's turning into such a good man.
I think Cedric is he's a great summary of a Hufflepuff. Like, he just really is the best example of a Hufflepuff, and we don't get much of that in the book. So it's a great way to show that, and it's like Harry wants to hate him, and he just can't hate him. He just can't. Mm-hmm. He just can't hate him.
And, I absolutely love when Harry's like, well, why don't we both take the cup? And Cedric's like, are you sure? And he gets this big smile on his face, and he helps Harry up, and they both grab the cup together, and that's legitimately where the chapter ends.
Yeah, I think they swirl, and then Cedric's next to him, and that's the end of the chapter. And you're like, dun, dun, dun. You're like, this was too easy. This was too easy. There's something going on here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there is, I would say something's afoot, dear Watson.
The game is afoot.
The game's afoot. But before we can get there, we got to wait a whole week, Drea, to see kind of where they've ended up.
Sorry.
As another franchise would say, I've got a bad feeling about this.
Yep.
But if anybody wants to catch up with you, talk to you about Harry Potter or anything else, maybe, send you a message about how much they love the show, where can they find you?
Hi, mate. You can find me on Twitter.
Good eye there, mate.
You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick, or you can find me on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
What's so funny is that for some reason, whenever we're closing out my other show, Cinema Stories, we give our information, we start with, well, you can find us on Twitter. I don't know why we do the British voice, but now we have the reason to do the Australian voice. You can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, and I'll stop now. And then you can find me on Instagram under that same name, just like Matt Weasley did. So you can also find me here on the network doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars every week. Honestly, you know, if you love Star Wars, this is a show for you. Check it out. I'm over on the Trek FM network talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine on the Orb with Chris Jones. I am doing the General Geek Show over there, which is called the 602 Club. We try to talk about as many fandoms as possible. Got the rest of the year planned out. Dre and I are eagerly anticipating talking about Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, The Crimes of Grindelwald when that comes out, as well as so many other things. So check that out. And then last but not least, as I mentioned, do Cinema Stories with Courtney. And that's where I talk about films with her through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.